thanks so much for coming on to the show. So we're going to be talking about human-centric leadership in data. So all good stuff. Why don't we start with maybe if you want to give a little bit of a intro on yourself, you know, how you've got to where you are today, and maybe we can go into, you know, how you've come to be passionate about this topic.
Yeah, for sure. Cheers for having me, Joe. So it's an interesting topic for me. It's a big important thing that I haven't really seen many others talk about until a couple of years ago. That's probably pretty much when I've added my voice to something. So a little bit about me. I'm the head of data engineering and data platforms at Co-op. For those of you who aren't in the UK, that's a big old convenience store with about 1,000 other industries underneath it, from legal services, funeral care, all the way through to insurance and schools, which is really cool. I am a neurodiversity advocate, a DE&I advocate. So whilst the world is going backwards on some of those things and desperately thinking that it's all solved, it's definitely not. I have really high ADHD scores. I've got ADHD myself. I'll always be rummaging around in this chair whilst we're recording. And for the longest time, I have struggled with systems and processes and people who don't understand what that means. That includes joining teams where managers haven't been helpful, haven't been understanding, haven't been thoughtful about some of the things that have been problematic for me. That has affected mental health. Mental health means don't perform well. It's a cycle. Over COVID and through an own personal mental health journey and around speaking to therapists, counselors, as well as doing more reading and research on books that I could possibly shake a stick at, I came to the conclusion that a new form of leadership is required, or one where people aren't just cogs in the machines there for profit, but they're actually treated as the people that they are, as an individual, because individuals are the best thing in the world. Being able to say hard conversations, hard comments with no judgment in the background, being able to have good conversations and feel safe in the office or safe at work or remotely is now becoming a more and more pressing thing, as we've seen over COVID, over the Great Resignation, as the media dubbed it, anti-work movements, and quite frankly, the attitude that people and organizations need to do better for the individual as opposed to doing their normal thing that they've been doing for years. So I've started spinning this up probably last year in a big way. I've always been very outspoken about treating people right. I don't get it right all the time, but I do try and get it right as much of the time as I can. I span this up. I've got a few blog posts. I've got a few comments. I speak publicly about it in the idea of inspiring new leaders to be focused on their people, not necessarily just the profits of the world.
Yeah, nice. And so interesting. So was there like a particular experience or even leader that sort of led you to be thinking like this, or was it more like an accumulation of different things?
It's a couple of them. There's a leader who really focused on me as an individual, but then there's the leaders I've experienced over my career who've been less focused on that and more focused on, well, it's about the people in the process. Well, it's not. It's about the individuals. And I've always felt quite isolated as a person with an attitude towards people. And you hear it an awful lot where it's like, oh, I want to work with people. I do want to work with people. But I've always felt that there's a lot of people above me who don't necessarily care for that. I worked with a fellow over 2021, who was my CTO, I think his title was, a fellow called Tony, who gave a damn about his team on an individual basis. He was really inspirational. He really stepped up during what was mad time for all of us 4 or 5 years ago, and really showed me how much he cared. I was going through some stuff in the background, and he'd check in with me every week. How's things? Everything okay? What do you need? And that quick check-in was just like a holy crap, there are other people out there who do care about their people a lot. From that, I've moved on to various other businesses, now Co-op kind of thing, and I've taken that mantra of checking in with my people and making sure they're okay and actually accepting that they have lives outside of their 37 and a half hours a week that we're supposed to have, checking in with them and saying, look, this is important. This is more important than you realize, and making sure the next generation or those who are in my reporting line and those by the side of can ask those questions safely, can ask those questions and be interested and ask those questions and help solve problems. So there's been some great leaders. There's been some not so great leaders who've caused the problems, who I think I decry on LinkedIn every single time I see it. But I think it is a funny one. It has been a difficult one, but it's been good to go on the journey more than anything.
Yeah, well, interesting that you're sort of talking about a positive experience leading you to this, because I was kind of half expecting it to be like maybe a bit of a horror story and, you know, like that's what I don't want to be. That has sort of led you down.
And I think we share Brits were prone to being a bit miserable and negative about things. But actually, like the Tony was the guy who started it off, where I sat there and went, holy crap, there are leaders out there who can do this. There are negative experiences. People who phone you at 8 o'clock on a Friday night, this thing's broken. I don't care that you're out with your family. You get this kind of stuff. People who don't care that you need special accommodations for disability or neurodivergence. That happens. That really, really does happen. And it's brutal and cold and horrible and isolating. Like, these things happen. But actually focusing on the negative only means that you'll focus on the negative and spread the negative, as opposed to having those positive experiences with a good manager. There's the meme that people don't leave bad businesses, they leave bad managers, is actually really true. Because people stick around. You can have an awful business, like, that's just carnage, but you can have a really good boss and go, I can stick with him. Because you see it time and time again, where teams, the head of or the lead leaves, and then the team just falls apart. And it was the manager holding things together. It was the leader holding things together. It was an individual holding that stuff together. So I think it's better to focus on the positives rather than the negatives in a big way.
Yeah, totally. And probably the reverse is true. I think you can have like a good business that's like performing, and, you know, even like the structures around the leadership might be good, but there might be a negative leader there and sort of like the opposite force. I mean, a lot of this stuff resonates with me, sort of coming from my industry in recruitment and sort of sales. Like, I think there is a lot of like traditional... Yeah, the old stereotype, banging on the table, like, where's my sales, you know? And, like, the reality is probably not as extreme as that in many cases. But, I mean, I've sat in a room before where the leader said, nobody's been sacked for a while. Who do we think should go? So that's probably
you leave notice on the desk, I'll have your job, like, 10 out of 10. Like, that's...
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it is crazy, and it's those kind of people that there is a traditional mindset. There's nothing wrong with the traditional mindset of certain things, hierarchical mindset. People grew up in certain ways, and like, it takes them a while to adapt. What we're asking them to do is adapt. It's not just continue to go down the same line. It's when you see the stereotype of it being the stereotypical white guy making the decision, right, everyone back to the office for 5 days. Come on, it's really good fun, is it? Because we have to tell you, you drive your nice air-conditioned like Land Rover that costs £300,000. Like, we don't have the same commute. We don't have the same setups. We don't have the same ability, the same privilege to be able to do these kind of things. Whereas actually, the individual matters. So those kind of people they need to adapt. And people are. And I think if you go and look at the media at the minute, they're currently decrying Gen Z as lazy and entitled, which I'm fairly certain as a millennial is my title from 15 years ago. And I'm very sure it's been given to somebody else, because now it's someone else's problem. But actually, like, it's more and more prevalent that these kids, for lack of a better phrase, because I'm mid-30s now and I feel like an old man. There's a lot of people out there now who get it in here, where mental health and physical health is way more important than any role, way more important than any leader who's banging on the table or closing the door and going, so we got to talk, and like having that weird power play, because it's still very much a common trope that people get in the workplace, this power-hungry maniacs at the top. But there's more and more of us who are now stepping into big leadership roles, senior leadership roles, and going, the line in the sand is drawn and we will not be doing that anymore. And if people sit there around them and say, well, no, possibly, it's just like, okay, so let's see how long you last with me. Like, because that's what it now needs to be. It's now about focused entirely on people as opposed to process and profits.
Yeah, interesting. And so you said, like, when you first sort of started looking into this and speaking about this a couple of years back, it like was quite new. But do you feel like things are shifting in the workplace towards what you're talking about?
I think, yeah, there's two sides of it. I think it is. I think people are more open with who they are now. I think business went through this bring your whole self to work kind of weirdness over the past 10 years. And I think that's been great. But it was always very bring your whole self to work. Oh, but not that bit. That bit's a bit controversial. Could you maybe just tile that down a bit, or could you be a bit more sensible in the office, or could you just pay more attention whilst you're here? You told me to bring my whole self, so I am. I think there's a generation who've kind of gone through that and kind of been like, well, if I'm bringing my whole self to work, that means I'm bringing my whole self to work, and you're going to full ADHD, or no, I can't not use my wheelchair, or no, I can't, like, because I've had a friend turn around and tell me that they've been told they have to use their walking frame rather than their wheelchair in the office.
Wow.
Yeah, it was an awful conversation. I was just like, have you stapled your boss to the wall yet with that one? It's very illegal to say, like, but it's a common thing. I think there's generation now of leaders who are stepping up and saying, look, bring your whole self to work. And phrases like, and one that I use is, I don't give a crap how or where you work, as long as you get your job done in 10 hours, more props to you. Like, if you get your job done in 40 hours, more props to you. Like, it's what it is. It's about focusing on those people who are smart enough to know how they already work. I think it's bringing a much more individual but collective individualism towards a workplace where it's, we know we're all individuals. We know it's not a family, because families are crazy sometimes, but we know we're going to bring our individual strengths to things. And a good leader, and there's a lot of them out there now, are starting to say, your strengths are the things that I miss. And they're starting to step up. And I think there's a lot of good stuff. There is also the other side of things where we're seeing the President of the United States universally declaring that DE&I is over and blaming people in wheelchairs for some of the worst air accidents in the world, where that seems like it isn't related, but it is a real kickback, knee jerk. The process has failed them. They want it to go back to the way it was in magical rose-tinted times, and people do still have issues where DE&I is not a big issue, or just get your job done. And it's just not that simple for everybody else. When you've got the population of the United Kingdom, where it's, I think it's 27% of us will have a mental health condition pop up, substantive mental health condition every year, that's a quarter of us. When it's neurodivergency, it's 1 in 10. I think it's 12.5% of us. So is that 8? It's an eighth of the population. You start realizing really, really quickly that actually there's a comorbidity there, but there's also people who are going to be outside of that. So you're probably looking at something like 40% of the population is going to need a leader who turns around and goes, hey man, you good? And then when you do the initial thing, because you're a white guy, and you go, yeah, I'm fine. And then you kind of look over my again and you kind of go, are you good? Like, I think it's like leaders have started doing that. I think people are getting better, but there are definitely the detractors out there, vocal detractors, who think that it's an attack on them as opposed to, hey, everybody just wants equitable treatment. So I think it's a funny one. I'm hoping it keeps up. And the UK seems to be disregarding a lot of the craziness in America at the moment, but it's a scary time for a lot of people who do just want better for a lot of people, as opposed to just brutalizing our way through life.
Yeah. Yes, best not to do that. Yeah. So when you've like, in your experience, when you've been sort of implementing this type of leadership, like, correct me if I'm wrong, I imagine it probably goes down pretty well with your team. But how's it received by, like, you know, above, or like the businesses themselves? Yeah.
It's a little quiet sometimes, actually. It's quite fun. The biggie I always get is I use my ADHD as a bit of leverage, because it's funny, because it's I'm flag waving ADHD guy. Neurodivergency is amazing. Like, it is always good fun, because it's like, I can break the water because I'm fairly self deprecating, but also got a witty sense of humor. Mostly, I'm just sarcastic. So it's one of those. I've sat in meetings with people, or sat in meetings with some fairly big directors, boards, C-suiters, and they've been speaking to me about it. They're like, yeah, but we already do that, and I've gone, yeah, okay, what do I need as an ADHD person? I just left them, and kind of they've just gone, oh, you'll need this, and you'll need that. And I've got, okay, have you actually asked me the question? You actually asked me and treated me as an individual rather than just a guy with an issue. Like, you need to treat them as individuals. And you kind of see them go, holy crap, yeah, that's a whole thing. I had a great session last year. There was a CDO summit at one of the big four consultancies. I can never remember which one it is. In London, I asked to swing by and sell the dream. And there was a guy who turned around, he said he got diagnosed over COVID with a neurodivergency. And he said, for the longest time, I thought I was empathetic. And he went, turns out I'm not. I'm not empathetic. I'm not listening to people. I'm not having that kind of conscious decision to drive good behaviors, to listen to people, active listening, that kind of thing. He's like, I've not actually done that. And it shocked me. And I think it's that people have the come to Jesus moment, for lack of a better phrase, because it's directly affected them, or they're sitting in front of someone who's not calling them out. Because if you turn around and go, you should be listening more, they'll go, don't need to listen to you. Mm-hmm. It was actually, have you bothered to ask me? Just this simple question that it goes mm-hmm. down. It goes down quite well. Some people don't care. Some people do not care. Like, I've got a friend who does a lot of advocacy internally for leadership training, and he's got his own consultancy and stuff. And he goes, there are some boards who just don't give a damn. Like, they're there for one thing, and it's their bank balance. It's looking good in the suit and stuff. And he went, those people aren't your priorities. Like, don't worry about them. Like, he's like, they're outnumbered massively. There's more people who aren't detractors who are on the, that's interesting, I didn't think of that, or just flat out advocates like me who are just mad about people. So it's about like tailoring it, because then it's about, if there's always going to be, if there's 10 people, there's always going to be a couple of them in there who are like, I don't care about any of that, but don't focus on that. It's not up to you to convince them. It's up to you to find the advocates in that team, because there's always a couple of them sitting there going, that's a great thing. We should be focused on our people. We should be doing, how can we you work with them? It rapidly propagates. And if you've got not detractors, but whatever the term is for people who are detractors, but aren't super positive about it, they'll quite quickly come to advocates, quite quickly to advocates, and be able to sell more of the good stuff, which is looking after our people and making sure our people develop properly and all that good stuff. They'll quickly come onto it, and detractors will find themselves outnumbered real quick, because everyone's got a horror story of a bad manager. Everyone's got a horror story. Like you said, slamming a hand on the table. Doesn't happen to everyone, but you've seen it and you've kind of gone, oh, that's a bit much. Don't like that. Like, and all it takes is one little person to sit there and go, could you not slam your hand on the table? It's like, well, you're fired. Well, it's not fair for them to be fired just because they've called you out. But it's one of those things that detractors will find themselves out of the place and having to adapt. And it's not something you can hide. It isn't something you can fake. It isn't something that's possible. You can do it to a certain extent, but there's something I say about neurodivergent people. We can smell a bullshitter. We can see someone who thinks that, you're really good for this kind of thing. They'll talk the talk, but won't walk the walk. And it's really quick. We can identify that kind of thing. So I think there's definite change. There's definitely good stuff. There's definitely bad stuff. And I think people will adapt now over the next, and they're going to have to, with Gen Z and Alpha, who are next, I think, whatever ridiculous title we're giving ourselves. And I don't like sitting there and saying it's all boomers' fault. So it's not. It's like all of us have got our own thing. Every single person's got their own individual story. And now we're focused on the individuals, as opposed to, I just need a business analyst, I just need a data engineer or an architect or whatever. Now I want to talk to an architect. Yeah, you got the skills. Talk to me about you. Like, for an interview with me, I'll talk to you for half an hour about you as a person. Like, tell me what makes you tick, how things work, how do you approach a problem? Like, talk to me about my stuff. Like, oh, you've got that. That's cool. That's a kick-ass way of doing it. Like, that's whatever it happens to be. Like, it's more about the individual, because then the individual buys into this kind of stuff and the individual continue to stick around because that's the right thing to do. So
that's interesting. Yeah, a bit of a segue into what I do there, I suppose. So you'll be aware, very aware, oftentimes you get a job description and it's basically just a list of technology, isn't it?
Yeah,
so the people side.
Use Python and R and Rust and, yeah, good luck with
that. Exactly, yeah. To do this BA job.
But
the people side, like, that can be harder to assess. And I guess, you know, with your focus on people over technology, like, that filters into how you recruit. So how do you do it? How do you assess the person as well as the tech and the skills?
Carl's got a process for it. Okay. We've just changed some of it, actually, to make sure it's more inclusive, which is awesome. Carl's got a process for it. I'm recruiting at the moment, so that's always good for it. No, you can't sell to me. Yeah, exactly, right? But it's so the big thing that I do is I have two sessions with them, and my lead engineers are just like, they are phenomenal techies, and they turned around and said, we need to find good people for it. We've hired a lot over the past year and we found some really good ones. So what we do is you have a conversation with me. If you can get on with Nick, you'll get on with anyone. Like, I don't think I'm difficult to get on with. I know I'm a handful, but I don't think I'm difficult to get on with. And so one of the things is I literally ask a plethora of questions to people. And I say, look, it's chats, conversations, if you've got questions, you sit there and I say something weird, just go, what does that mean? What is that? Where's that? Like, whatever it means to them. And I try and find the best people. I speak to so many good people from every possible background. I've got one guy who's got a combination in his history that's just absolutely bonkers to think of. And he was a lad who we ended up talking about Fourier synthesis in an interview, and watched two of my seniors look at each other and go, God's name is that, and Googled it afterwards and like, why do you two know this? And it's like, because we're nerds, man. That's what we do.
Nice.
So it's one of those things where I talk to people very kind of open and honestly. Look, here's the process. Here's how we do these things. We're going to ask a few technical questions. Have the questions up front so you can have a think about them. We're going to ask you about co-op. We're going to ask you about the behaviors that we expect from you. Then we're going to have a conversation. We'll do this separate. We'll do the conversation with Nick beforehand and a technical thing afterwards, because blending the two together isn't for everyone. That context switch can be whiplash. If they need making sure they're okay. And it's like, would you like to proceed? Do you want a 5-minute break? Get a can of Coke, quick cup of coffee? Do you want something like that? Yeah, that's great, because it lets you have a separation. When I came into co-op, one of the first things I said was, like, I've got ADHD. So, and Claire, the last who interviewed me, and hang on a second, what does that mean? What do you need from me? I've never been asked it before. I'm like, I just need you to understand that occasionally I'll be doing this, but I will be paying attention and I'll be sitting there playing with books and being like fiddling with things now, like to keep myself entertained. But it's very much about that. And I had the same thing when I went to the office as well. Like Andrew, the fellow who interviewed me at the time, was just like, right, you've done your big technical bit. He's like, do you want a break? Do you want a break? I'm like, I'd love 10 minutes, just get through, look out the window for 10 minutes, let my brain decompress a little bit so I can switch back to context. Yeah, that was all they did. I made sure I had that time, and he just wandered back to see me. He's like, you ready? I'm like, yeah, grand, cool, let's go, kind of thing. It's that breathing space to be doing things. But the conversationality of it, it's not grilling. Like, I'm not there to be grilled. No one's there to say, tell me how you know Data Vault.
Yes.
Talk to me about Data Vault. What do you know about it? How do you know about it? What's its pros, its cons? Talk to me. Like, just tell me things. Tell me things that comes off your brain. If it comes out like ChatGPT and you're able to say the word Zed and anything, I know you're lying, but it's one of those things. And then it's about them as well. It's about them. I've recently interviewed some juniors. One of them was really sharp, really quite sheepish about, oh, well, I had a bit of a career break. He goes, oh, what happened? Is everything okay? Oh, yeah, I had two kids. Awesome. Tell me about your kids. What do they do? Like, what do they love, kind of thing? And the kids love Lego. Great. Wonderful. I've got a massive Lego International Space Station sat by me. Like, it's that kind of exuberance that you are a human being with love and knowledge and madness that kind of comes to you. And also, so are they with people around them. And it's paying attention to that. And it's that kind of acceptance that they've got bigger things in their background, whereas a lot of people will hide that. I don't want people to do that. I want people to be more vocal, because the more inclusive I can be to every possible combination of person, the more they will be in the future, and they can happily step up and be the next leaders, next human-centric leaders, or whatever combination of words we use to sound like a good person. So it's one of those. Yeah, it's a difficult one. Recruitment's hard as well, because you have to make sure everything's prim, proper, detailed, and inclusive. And it's not an easy thing.
No. Interesting. And what about, how does all this work in, because it's all super positive, and like, I believe like good people will, people who are happy will likely perform better, right?
Yeah.
And so there's loads of positivity. How does it work? You know, sometimes there are just issues, and sometimes there are like not the right fit in the right place or the right role. Like, how does all of this, like human-centric leadership, how does that deal with like those situations where it's not working out, or there's confrontation, or if someone is just, you know,
problematic,
taking, yeah.
Yeah, it does happen. I had a really good example. I always tie it back to neurodiversity for me, neurodivergence for me, because it's the thing that I defaulted to. Did some speaking last year, and someone stepped up and said, like, they had a neurodivergent person in their team who was basically a jackass. There was no other word for it. They were awful, awful human being. They had a public speaker in. They were decrying them, insulting them with all sorts of things. And they were just like, how do you deal with that? I'm like, that's not a neurodivergence issue. That's a HR problem. Like, that's a fundamental cannot function in society problem and not your issue to solve. When it comes down to like breaching the big social contracts aspects of this, like racially motivated or bullying or anything like that, not acceptable under any circumstances. Like, it doesn't matter if I'm a human-centric leadership. Like, bullies piss me off to no end. And if I find them in an organization, I root them out generally and make sure they understand it. When it comes to managing people, if you've got people who aren't performing, a lot of people sit there and go, oh, well, we've got a performance process for that. It's never set up for people. I've got a friend who's recently had to let a couple of neurodivergent guys go because the process said to, as opposed to, he fought their corner. He fought their corner the whole way. And he spoke to me about it a lot, and he was really upset about it because the business just didn't care. It didn't care that they needed accommodations for this and also wouldn't give them accommodations. So it was infuriating. But it's about making sure people have got all the right accommodations. But then it's about having that conversation with people. People are terrified to have their boss turn around and say, are you sure this is the right place for you? Because they think they're getting fired. I'm lucky the engineers I've got, I don't have this problem, but I have had it a couple of times before where I've said very openly, like, what do you want to do with your career? I want to be a data scientist. Okay, cool. Do you think that's the best for you because maths isn't your strong point? Or is it, I'm really determined. Okay, how can we support you through that? Because we can support you into that guidance we can support you through that as much as we can. But ultimately, it comes down to aptitude. It comes down to what you want to do. And you probably can do that. Like, as a guy with no university degree and whose GCSEs smell fudge egg, like, so be it. Like, it's a good thing to have those aspirations. But there comes a point where it's not a people issue. It's a fundamental people issue. They're a problem. They're a nasty piece of work. It's a bad hire, that kind of thing. The process works for that because being different doesn't mean you get an excuse to be a jackass. Like, you can be different and be a jackass. That's me. Like, I'm not a jackass because I'm neurodivergent. Like, it's one of those. So it is one of those things that kind of comes there. And then it's just about being honest and open with those people. Like, if you're going through that process, I don't think it's right for you. What do you think is right for you? Well, I really want to do this. Okay. But the writing's on the wall, mate. Like, if the conversation is, we're not performing, you're not performing, there's issues with quality of work, we've tried absolutely everything, is it the right career for you? I want to be an astronaut. I would kill to go to space. I am a 6'4", rather overweight gentleman, not going to happen. Like, so I have to kind of say what that is. But it is the same kind of attitude that we have to take to people. I mean, we do have to have hard conversations with people on the lines of, I don't think you're suited for that yet. We will do everything in our power to do so and get you to that position. But there may come a point where you have to admit that it can't happen. I'm not going to run a marathon anytime soon. I'd love to, not going to. But it's about focusing on people's priorities and focusing about on the realism of a situation as opposed to probably the utopic attitude that we are given as individuals through school and reinforced through university, which is anyone can do anything within reason. Like, and that sounds horribly exclusive, but it's true. Like,
yeah.
And I hate saying it, but like, it's about the realism, the pragmatism for the situation. Like, there's not a lot you can do more.
Fish can't climb a tree, right?
I'd like to see that. Like, I guarantee AI could give us that image. But yeah, it is. But it is very much the case. And I hate it because there are certain things in there. But I do think we are deluded to ourselves and hold ourselves to such a high account that I could be anything I want to be. I guarantee you can't be a gas giant. And that's me. That's the reality, sad reality of the world, a practical, pragmatic and realistic attitude towards things as a leader. It's something I've had multiple times, and they're the leaders who I've resonated with, not the can sing me a song about the greatest thing in the world, not the pessimists who sit there constantly telling me, oh, it's just another day in paradise. None of that. It's the realists, the pragmatists who've gone, right, what are you trying to do? Where are you looking at? What's the next steps? Like, those people to bring a logical, rational, very unemotional attachment to it, so it gives you that kind of area to grow. Like, they're the ones who I've admired over my career, And it might be different for other people, but it's as leaders, that's what we have to do. We have to have a pragmatic and realistic attitude towards this, especially with humans, because we're all a bit weird. We're all a bit wonky. And that's the best bit about us.
Yeah, sure. Because like when I don't think I'd come across the term before we started talking of human-centric leadership, even maybe psychological safety. But like on first glance, you could look at it as like being nice. Do you know what I mean? Like, but I suppose it doesn't necessarily mean that anything is any less accountable or that it's necessarily more lenient.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. The term, I kind of hijacked the term a little bit. Over COVID, I started getting certified as a counselor because therapy is awesome and love the notion of it. Want to do it in the future because I think it's the best thing in the world. There's a focus on it called people-centric therapy and counseling. It's very much an approach to sitting down with an individual and being your whole self during that, giving them unconditional regards and making sure people are safe, And the entire time I went through my own struggles over COVID, I'd lost my brother just before COVID. I went through counseling, thought it was the best thing in the world. This is much better. But it's one of those things that I sat there and went, holy crap, this approach works so well to interpersonal relationships for just about everything. And I'm not talking like the weird faux therapy speak you do hear some people saying. It's not a case of that. I'm still the same human being who's talking to Joe right now. Like, this is just the way I talk to people. It's very, probably a bit more swearing when I'm not on a podcast. A lot more swearing when I'm on a podcast.
I've seen.
Yeah. Well, the guys last Thursday definitely encountered my swearing in a big way. So my bad. So it's one of those things. Whereas people centric is very, very about sitting down with the individual, helping them figure themselves out, unconditional regard for them, congruence to yourself, who you are, how you feel about a situation. Because one of the big things is very much like you're going to encounter employees who are having the worst day of their life, whether they've been fired, something massive has happened in their past. A divorce has happened. Something awful has happened to their child. You are going to have to respond in a way that is, you know how you feel about that as well. I've had to work with people who've had the worst day of their lives. I've had to speak to people who have pretty much got the phone call. You need to come home. Something's happened to Jimmy. And I'm just like, about it. Right. Go home. Like you're no use to me, let alone to yourself. No use to yourself, let alone to me. Please go home and get yourself sorted. Like, don't worry about any of this. It doesn't matter. Not emergency service. Yeah. Don't worry about it. So it's one of those. It's that unconditional regard for people that how I feel about the situation means that I can work with them when they've come back to work a few weeks later and they've gone through it and everything like that. It's the I'm listening to you. It's active listening. I'm paying attention to you. It's the whole approach to it. I mean, this kind of stuff was built into in a very high level into the Agile framework as well. I'm a cultist for Agile. I think it works really, really well. Psychological safety is in there. If you haven't got a safe team, like they'll never want to make risks. They'll never want to change beyond just doing tickets.
Mm.
So the psychological safety comes into having a leader who can have these really hard conversations and come away not upsetting people, not giving people bad attitudes, but like really pushing hard to do the right thing. And you also, when it comes to the individual, one of the ones I always say is about being able to show who you are. I don't drink anymore. Like I used to drink like an absolute fish, don't drink anymore. And people find out and they're like, holy crap, like that's mad. Like 5.5 years. Like, and people sit there and they're like, oh wow. Like if you're open with it, ADHD, mental health issues, people feel more safe because they know you've been through it. And you find really, really quickly that people will start feeling safe with you. But also, folks are going to come to you with their own pasts. Maybe they were knocked about as a kid. Awful things happen. Schoolyard bullying. That stuff sticks with you. That stuff sticks with you for your entire life. Like that kind of thing. And you don't recognize it in people. You don't recognize it in people because you're too busy and you're too thinking about it. Whereas with people, that psychological safety means you don't raise your voice in certain areas. You moderate how you behave. You have to make sure that people do feel safe for this. I have a great deal of banter with my team. Genuinely have great deals of banter with my team. I think I'm one of the few leaders who's still not massively unafraid of doing that. But it never strives into places where it's just like horrendous. It's more like they'll take the mickey out of me for 20 minutes late to a meeting and be like, sorry. And we'll be like, oh, always late. Oh, you've got nice watch on, and I'll have a bit of a giggle with each other. They're safe to do that because that's the modicum of being a good boss. Like, you're supposed to be able to take these things on the chin and have a good laugh with it. But there's also people who are going to know if I start talking about complex post-traumatic stress disorder or ADHD or mental health issues, anxiety, whatever it happens to be. And I can sit there and go, yeah, that resonates with me. I've got another leader who's my peer, who's similar. We speak up about these things and we're honest about them. So people go, holy crap, I'm safe. I'm safe here. And it's not a big deal. It's not a massive deal. It's not a big deal. They don't have to worry about triggers or anything like that. And it becomes a psychologically safe environment where people can have honest conversations, hard, honest conversations, and not come away feeling like they're being judged or that their job's going to be disappearing anytime soon. Or because that's the biggie. That's the biggie where, hey, if you've got 5 minutes to talk from your boss's boss or your boss kind of thing, it's just like, what have I done?
Yeah.
And you get it and it's like, oh, I just wanted to talk to you about that thing we delivered a couple of weeks ago. Tell me that on Teams, man. just say that, like how easy it is to actually just accept that people have got bits that it's okay for you to say, it's okay for a director or a head off to sit there and go, I need 5 minutes of your time because they're busy. But it's not. We've got 5 minutes of your time. Just want to talk about this. That's it. It's silly things like that that help people feel more safe at work.
Interesting. And you mentioned, like you said, everyone's got horror stories, right? So I imagine somebody maybe coming from one of those horror stories into joining your team, like it must be like, wow, like this is amazing. So like what experiences have you seen like that? Or like, you know, what's it done for productivity and things like that?
The situations I get, I think a lot of people will end up talking to my lead engineers more than me. I try not to be super duper or uber duper friendly because it gets a bit weird really quickly. Especially with quite intense, like 40 people having my intensity around them is hard. So for me, I've had a couple of people in the past where they've, like, I've sat in interviews with them. They're like, I just want to work with you, man. I want to work with someone who's not a complete lunatic. Good luck at my own weirdness in my own way. And afterwards, like after a couple of months, I'll check in and be like, how are things? Every couple of weeks, I talk to most people in my team anyway. I'll pop them a message or whatever, and I'll just say, how are things? Or I'll bump into them in the office and they'll say, how's things? And it's just, you're like, you have no idea how much better my life is, kind of thing. It's just like, what? Because you're not stressed out about work constantly, not worried about losing your job or anything like that. It's just, that's the response I've got from it. And you find, default back to some neurodivergent stuff, like you create a good culture for people. We work better. We work better. We work faster. We're more accurate. We're more willing to go the extra mile because we know the boss above us is going to be fair and honest with us. I've worked some long hours before, like up until like 11 o'clock at night on a Friday because my brain just couldn't get a thing out. Messaged my boss and he's got back to me and said like, look, here's the deal. It's this. And it's just like, okay, fine, brilliant. And take next Friday off, take whatever you need to do, because that's the balance that I can get with people. I do the same thing if I know people have taken time off or I know people need an extra bit of time. Like if they can do it, it's that balanced, nuanced way that leadership's supposed to be, as opposed to just you are here from 9 to 5 or you've worked after 5 o'clock. You've worked after 5 o'clock and it's just diddums. I think that's what you get from it. You get people who are more productive, more thoughtful, more interested in what you're trying to solve and what you're trying to achieve, as opposed to like most people are just going to want to come in 9 to 5. That's fine. Even in the data world, we are a cult unto ourselves, but like it's okay for them to just come and do their 9 to 5. But like when they do put the extra hours in or they put the extra mile in because they're safe to do so and they know they're going to get something back, they will. Like people will work better and be mission focused and objective focused rather than just going to put the hours in. Like, and that's where it starts coming from. You see better performance. You see better performance from people. You see more people being more curious. You see people having better conversations and honest conversations. You will see better solutions. We come up with some wacky things sometimes. And I'm just like, that is a bad idea. not in a bad way, because that is going to get really expensive. Yeah, but it's cool. I don't care if it's cool. It's a cool in 24 months when agentic AI is not as expensive as it is, like whatever it happens to be. Like, so it's one of those that you can have those kind of chats, you can have those conversations, the productivity goes up in a team for that, especially data teams. Data teams are hard work to encourage good people into, and we come with our own set of complex needs, whether that's technology through to attitudes towards things.
Yeah, no, I fully believe that, because I think, you know, I've had periods in my career where, you know, the culture has been more sort of driven on fear, and I've had periods where that's not the case at all. And certainly in my own work and my own performance, it's just a mile apart, you know, so I can fully believe that. So it sounds like, sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, it's awful that all of us have to put up with it a little bit.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And I definitely, like I said before, I think my industry, there's a lot of it. I mean, I'm sure it's changing, like everywhere is probably changing. But I think sales generally has a bit of a traditional leadership kind of reputation.
And yeah. I think the guys who, I know plenty of guys who've started their own recruitment firms. I know plenty of guys who've started their own sales or marketing or whatever. And the guy on LinkedIn is not the guy you end up speaking to. Like that's
no.
like, and it is one of those. I think more and more people will do their own thing. More and more people will, guys and gals. There's at least one lass, Emma, up in Manchester. She's Mariah Talent. She's brilliant. She's literally built her own firm off the back of like doing good for others and like stuff like that. She's inspirational when it comes down to this.
Nice.
Yeah. So it's one of those.
Okay. And it sounds like when you started a co-op, they were fairly forward thinking with regards to DE&I. At the same time, it's still like a, you know, it's a big business. And so, you know, you've mentioned like remote work before now. So, and you're obviously very pro for remote work. Did you get any pushback on any of how you felt you should sort of be leading the teams?
No, I started, and then our new director came on, I think it was March last year. He got to know me quite quickly with stuff. He was like, obviously he's a Londoner. I live in London as well. Co-op's main office is in Manchester. So it's like, how often do you go up? I go up once every month for a few days. I grab a nice hotel, see some friends up there in the evenings. It's awful. It's dreadful. But like the attitude I took straight away is like, my team's remote first. Data engineers work best when they're together, and that could be digital or not. Like, under no circumstances do you sit there and you're making unilateral decisions about return to office. And he kind of went, yeah, it's fair enough. Like, co-op's not going to do that. Like, even you see, what's his name, Lord Rose, who got himself in trouble a couple of weeks ago, where it was just like, oh, return to office is the right thing to do. Like, shut up, man. Like, even co-op ourselves turn around and publicly stated flexible work is here to stay. It is the future of work, because we've all got laptops. We all can dot around. We can go to the coffee shop. I can take my dog to the coffee shop on a Wednesday, get my head down. He can sit next to me and doze in the sun, kind of thing. It sounds ridiculous, but it's a good thing to be able to do. I can get little jobs done around the house. I can get jobs done for life. Because then I'll work these weird hours that allow me to do that. I've never got any pushback for it. I know a lot of organizations are, for various traditional reasons / real estate prices / stealth layoffs, that are quite frankly indicative of cowardly leadership. And I'm always quite keen to call these people out whenever I can. But it's definitely one of those huge issues that doesn't actually get done at co-op. Co-op's still got places like where we can do better. I know that. And that's, I'm part of a group internally represent, and I'm part of the wider tech team to be able to promote DE. And I come from the place of neurodivergency. We've got people on there who come from I have no idea what the actual term is now. It used to be BAME, and I'm not sure what the actual term is for it anymore. BIPOC is American, so I try not to use it. But it's like they come from an area where it's just like... that each of us has an attitude towards things that is our own personal advocacy. So it's that advocacy that we can do, and we challenge things, and we make sure internal processes are better. We make sure that things are written down or accessible, or even challenging the status quo to turn around and say, that's just really bad for this particular reason. Can we stop using it? Yes, absolutely. Done and dusted. So there's that kind of stuff that's actually in there. Yeah, so that's generally what it is. I think there's a lot of organizations that want to do more, and employees are the people who, like, you go on LinkedIn, it's always culture comes from the top. Culture does not come from the top. Culture comes from the bottom up. Like, it is generated by the people who are doing the grafts. Like, there's a reason armed forces units end up having cultures internally in very small troops and squads and platoons and stuff like that, is because they are working together so closely. It's not the top dogs, not the general sitting there giving, this is how we're going to work together, boys. No, it's a very specific culture. It's also very specific to how small teams work. There's a culture around those things that propagates very, very quickly. It can be tailored by senior management, but ultimately it's not about senior leaders turning around and giving that. It's that cultural idiom that can allow for growth and change. Remote work is here to stay. Flexible working is here to stay. As long as the work gets done, where do you care where it gets done? That's the attitude. And the big thing for big one I always leave with a lot of leaders, I've got into quite heated arguments in person about it, and I've just gone, what are you scared of? What are you worried about? Is it your job you're worried about? Because if it's you're worried about not being able to do your job with this, then hey, you can learn real quick. Or B, you can become irrelevant. Like, you learn real quick or become irrelevant. Why would I hire someone who's sitting there going, work from home is dead. Return to office is all that's going to be important. I wouldn't hire you.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't bring, you denigrate against the culture of the teams that I'm trying to build. Like, I would hire people who look at flexibility and realize that everybody's an individual, and we each have our own individuality to that, that comprises up into a culture that works really well. I don't know what else people expect from it, but co-op's great for it. We know there's always improvements to be made. Co-op's really good for it. I think a lot of other firms are better for it. I think the big firms have got a lot to learn, but they'll get there. And I have faith with the amount of people who speak about issues and call people out and generally cause mayhem with myself. I do believe we will change that for the future. And I think it will be good.
Yeah, well, as a recruiter, obviously it's changed a lot, hasn't it? And like, yeah, if I'm going to market with a job and it's like 4 days in the office a week, like your pool of candidates is so immediately so much narrower, it's so much more difficult. So I fully agree, it's changing.
Yeah, it is, and I think it's down to just pure flexibility. Like, I haven't been to the office in February because I've had stuff going on, getting various bits of DIY done at home and like getting tradies in and things like that. That's life. Whereas March, I'm up twice for a few days, 2 weeks. That's life. It's not about a mandated thing. It's about where I can be at a certain period of time. Otherwise it doesn't work. It just won't work. And my team know where I am. They know what hours I work. They know my team's little green dot is always off. I switch that off straight away, and I've just like, look, pop me a message. As soon as I see it, I'll get back to you. I'll make some time for you. Like, that's what it's about. That's how flexible working works. It's not necessarily an asynchronous thing, but it's, I will make time for people. So,
yeah. I think what's really interesting about the whole thing, not specifically flexible working, but the human-centric leadership and psychological safety and all of that, is like, it's part of like being a good person, right? Which everybody should want to be. Yeah. But also I think it's like good business, because like what we were talking about is like, you're going to get happy staff, and that's going to lead to sort of performance and improvements and innovation and, you know, all of that good stuff, really.
It will. And it really does. It drives the good stuff in there. And I think it's something I've said for a long time. I love people, but I hate what society can do to them sometimes. And business and organization is no different from that. You can have the best human being in the world, and if they're working for the wrong organization, the organization's culture will rub off on them and make them positively awful to be around. I've had a close friend who's worked for a big American bank before, came back, and he's like a different human being until he got like 6 months in and was just like, ooh, I didn't realize that was a problem that I'd brought with me, kind of attitude towards things. I don't like what big organizations can do to people. I don't like that it can make us money grubbers. I don't like it that it can make people really cold and hostile towards each other, because I had this really weird moment. I worked in Canary Wharf in 2019. I had this really weird moment where I sat on the DLR just looking down the train, like, all these people are going to competitors of my business or the business I work for. This is weird. Like, none of us are truly competitors in any way, shape, or form. Like, the very, very top dogs probably are, because names and egos and that kind of stuff. But I just sat there for ages, like, that's weird. Like, we all use the same thing. We all do the same way into the office. Like, we're not competitors in the slightest. We're just here to make money. So, like, we're here to make money so we can survive. Like, that's the vast majority. And if you told most people, ask most people, oh, what do you want to do? If you didn't have to work, what do you want to do? Guarantee it's not their job. Guarantee it's not their job. They tell you they want to raise dogs or horses or have a smaller orchard that they tend to. Like, people have these aspirations and dreams that it's not to work in a big business. Some people are to have these massive, crazy, like, careers and things like that. If you looked at 15-year-old me, saw me now, it'd just be like, how the hell did you manage that? Couldn't tell you, dude. But I think, like, people are like that. I think it's indicative of the fact that we have to get to a point where we accept that people are going to want different things, or we accept that people aren't always going to align to corporate culture as opposed to a focus more on the individuals that they actually work around, because that's how it's going to happen. That's how change happens anyway. And I think it is slowly going in the right direction, contrary to popular belief.
Yeah. Led by you and your talks and blogs.
God, I hope so, mate. God, I hope so. Yeah. I'm starting to do more public speaking about it. I love doing it. Thank you for having me on for this, by the way. I love doing it. And then it's like I'm looking at pivoting it into something middle of this year and helping organizations or startups. I've always spoken to a couple about them, about how to build a good culture. I'm looking forward to doing more of that kind of like advisory, how to be a good person. We're taught to that, but like, how do you actually put that into place as an application rather than just a boisterous statement of intent on LinkedIn? how do you actually do that? And like, that's what I'm like, I'm always going to be a data guy. I'm probably going to be a client for quite a while, but it's like that advisory, you guys are the next generation. Go forth and be awesome, as I say to my team an awful lot.
Nice.
That's what I want from people, and that's what I want more and more to do. Because if I can inspire 1 out of 1,000 people, that's one more person who's going to go on and on and on. It's exponential at that point. I'll be happy that at least 10 people get a better world from it.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to seeing it. Yeah, Nick, it's all super interesting. I am genuinely interested in this subject matter. So, I'll continue following. Yeah, do it. Yeah, for sure. Thanks so much.
Much appreciated, dude.